17.8% of the American economy. The Senate is going to figure out health care in the next 2 weeks. Oh, and by the way, throw in some tax policy as well. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, today the 13th of June, by my calendar. Good as always to have you along, everybody. There are, as of right now, by that very same calendar, 13 working days left until the Senate of the United States takes its Independence Day holiday. I mention that because Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has said he wants a vote on the health care bill before everybody leaves town. Put another way, the Senate is going to vote on the shape and substance of fully one-sixth of the American economy sometime in the next 2 weeks without so far any public hearings or releasing the text of the bill. And at the same time, is going to try to get some tax policy done as well. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour starts us off.
Some people call the American Health Care Act a health care bill, but you wouldn't be wrong to call it a tax bill.
When you look at the components of the health care bill, the major components are reduction in spending in Medicaid and then a bunch of tax provisions.
Dick Harvey teaches law at Villanova. Tax provisions that add up, says Howard Gleckman with the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center.
The health bill includes about $1 trillion of tax cuts, which would mostly benefit high-income people.
One of those is a particular tax that the Trump administration and Republicans really want to lower, a certain type of capital gains tax on investments that was raised to fund Obamacare. Capital gains is now at 24%. House Republicans want it down to 16.5%, a big cut. Gleckman says they can chip away at this in the health care bill.
It wouldn't look like quite as big a tax cut for high-income people because they would have already gotten nearly half the tax cut in the health care bill at a time when no one was really paying attention to it.
But if the goal of tax reform is reducing the deficit, which it is for some Republican lawmakers, health care reform doesn't move them very far along. Despite all the tax cuts in the health care bill, it doesn't reduce the deficit by much more than a rounding error, $120 billion over 10 years. Scott Greenberg is with the Tax Foundation. He says Congress could just let go of the health care reform taxes and find tax cuts elsewhere.
In that case, the failure of a health care bill has no budgetary impact whatsoever on the prospects for a tax reform bill.
Outside one or two taxes, he says, all the tax reform going on inside healthcare, that's about healthcare. It doesn't change the math or the mess of tax reform to come. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
In energy news today, Goldman Sachs is making some financial noise on climate change. President Trump may have pulled the United States out of the Paris Agreement, but Goldman is making a big move into wind and solar energy and the buying and selling thereof. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong has that one.
Goldman has inked a wind power deal to help run all its buildings and data centers on 100% renewable energy eventually. And now it plans to broker similar deals for other big companies. Hervé Tuity at the Rocky Mountain Institute think tank says name brand companies have made clean energy promises to their customers and their workers.
If you are a very well-known brand like Google or Amazon or Apple, it's very important for you, and it's why those companies started first. More companies are joining the club because they see their peers doing it and they don't want to be left behind.
Or left behind another trend of saving money. Wind and solar power are increasingly price competitive with fossil fuels. Now here's where banks like Goldman come in. To help companies find renewable energy deals, negotiate them, and handle any unforeseen costs or market changes. Attorney Peter Mostow is with the firm Wilson Sonsini.
In the energy market, we're just starting to see the financial players trying to offer a product that exposes them to the renewable energy market, but without these difficult-to-digest risks.
The goal is to lubricate the green power market and to grow it, which is entirely separate from Washington's inaction on climate. In fact, Greg Whetstone at the American Council for Renewable Energy says when the Trump administration left the Paris deal, companies and states reaffirmed their efforts to fill the gap.
We've actually done the analysis of how much we need to grow our sector, and this is happening already, in order to achieve at least our first Paris goal in 2025. We think we can get there.
It'll be a test of how big and how fast a low-carbon economy can grow. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Quick update now from the conversation I had with Molly Wood yesterday about Uber. The report on the company's culture issues, shall we say, came out today. The headline item is that founder and CEO Travis Kalanick is going to take a leave of absence, 3 months, it looks like. Also, and not for nothing, but the Verizon-Yahoo deal closed today. Verizon got Yahoo's core assets for a quite reasonable $4.48 billion. Quite reasonable Because back in the day, if you remember this, Yahoo was worth $100 billion American dollars or more. CEO Marissa Meyer is gone. The new Verizon-Yahoo combo, to be called Oath, is going to be run by AOL CEO Tim Armstrong and includes HuffPost and TechCrunch, to name just a couple. Here with tomorrow's news today, the Fed is going to make an announcement about interest rates tomorrow afternoon. A quarter point hike, that is my guess. Wall Street today higher. Without a whole lot of enthusiasm, though, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. It was pretty much all Russia all the time at the Senate Intelligence Committee hearing today. Who from the Trump campaign might have met with whom from the Russian side? Attorney General Jeff Sessions was at the witness table. Things got a little testy, depending on who from which party was doing the questioning. What's not really open to question, though, is that the Russians did try to manipulate the 2016 elections. A new investigation out today from Bloomberg shows the digital intrusion was far more widespread than thought. 39 state election infrastructures were possibly affected. Michael Riley shared the byline on the story. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thanks.
So this is not, just to be clear, it's not the Russians actually manipulating the vote, but it is the Russians hacking into voting systems.
That's right. They are not, as far as we can tell, based on the systems they were hacking into, they weren't really trying to change the tally of the votes. That's a really hard thing to do anyway. It's the voting process is really disparate. There are 7,000 jurisdictions that run these things. It's mostly run at a county level. But they were hitting systems that looked like you could create some chaos on election day. And that was the thing that worried the Obama administration.
The Obama administration, you say, used another piece of cyber infrastructure, sort of the digital equivalent of the red phone, to get a hold of the Kremlin and say, hey, listen, we know you're doing this. Cut it out.
That's right. Yeah. So the red phone, it's not actually a phone and it's not actually red, but it does go back to the Cold War. And originally it was developed to defuse a nuclear crisis. In about 2011, they created a separate channel, same system, separate channel for cyber. And this is the first time it was used. And keep in mind that the important thing to know is you use this system when you think an aggressive act has occurred. So that alone, pulling the trigger on the system alone, showed you how seriously they were taking this. The response of the Russians was chilly at best. They basically said, oh, thanks very much for the information, and we'll look into it.
Give me a sense of scale here, specifically with Illinois, because they let the feds in to sort of have a look at their data. What kind of information was compromised? What exactly happened?
Sure. So sometime in early July, a computer technician who I think worked 3 days a week for the state noticed that something weird was going on in terms of the state voter database. There was data leaving the system at times that it wasn't supposed to be leaving it. They looked into it a little more, figured out it looked pretty serious. So they rang the alarm bells. And unlike many of the states, they invited the federal investigators, FBI and DHS, to come and have a look. What they ultimately found was, you know, that they hit a statewide voter database, which contained all the information about all the voters in the state. And as many as 200,000 of those records had been accessed by the hackers by the time the investigators got there. But the other thing they found was that the hackers had tried to either alter or delete the data. And this sent a bunch of alarm bells off for the Obama administration. This was an effort to try and see if you could change the data in the system. And their view was that the reason they were doing that is to create the kind of instability on election day that could create huge problems.
And we should say, as far as we know, no votes were changed. No tabulation was actually messed with, but other parts of the infrastructure were. Arguably, the most troubling part of this piece is buried somewhere in the middle. You quote a former senior U.S. official expressing concern that the Russians now have 3 more years before 2020 to build on their knowledge, plus whatever they did in the last, you know, however many years it was that they were poking around before.
That's right. And in fact, there's a question about why the Russians didn't actually pull the trigger on some of these capabilities on election day. Maybe the pushback worked. But one of the people that was right in the center of this stuff, who I talked to, said he thought it was because, in fact, the system is so hard to understand and so complicated, even after months of hacking, the Russians just didn't have enough to do what they wanted to do. But he said he pointed out they learned a heck of a lot. And what they learned, they can now continue to sort of build on over the next months, and we should continue to expect them to do so. And they're likely to come back and try it again in 2018 or 2020. And that's exactly what former FBI Director Comey said in the hearing. He's like, these guys are coming after us, and they will be back.
Michael Riley with Jordan Robertson today had a byline on the Bloomberg piece about Russian hacks into the U.S. electoral system. Michael, thanks a lot.
You bet.
You drive west out of Philadelphia for about an hour or so, and you hit Kennett Square, Pennsylvania, source of more than half of all the mushrooms grown in the United States every year. Thing is, all those baby portobellos and shiitakes don't pick themselves, you know. They are harvested by hand almost entirely by immigrants, some of them undocumented, from Mexico and Guatemala, which has growers paying close attention to changing immigration policies. WHYY's Laura Benchoff has the story.
Chris Alonso is a third-generation mushroom grower. He's descended from Italian immigrants who founded his company, Pietro Industries. But today, workers here speak Spanish.
Hey, Antonio, ¿cómo está? Buenos días.
In a nearby growing room, a group of harvesters pick from giant stainless steel shelves filled with peat moss and blanketed with white mushroom caps. The shelves are stacked like bunk beds from floor to ceiling, and the room is cool and damp.
Our employees started at 4 in the morning, which is also why I think that sometimes it's difficult to find Americans that want to do the work.
Pickers are paid by the pound, so a slow harvester may bring in $8 an hour, already above minimum wage, while an experienced one can bring in 12 or 14, growers say. In Chester County, home to both farms and wealthy bedroom communities for Philadelphia and Delaware, available workers are scarce. Unemployment is below 4%, the lowest in the state. Against that backdrop, stepped-up immigration enforcement has made mushroom growers skittish, says Alonso.
There's uncertainty with businesses. A lot of businesses have slowed down their investment in new equipment because we're unsure of the workforce situation.
At a Know Your Rights meeting earlier this year, workers' concerns were on display. More than 200 people packed into the lobby of local social service provider La Comunidad Hispana to have their questions answered by immigration attorneys. To protect their identities, audience members wrote questions on index cards, which the group's director, Elisa Jones, read aloud.
I am undocumented and work at a mushroom farm. I drive without a license to get to work. Is driving without a license a reason to be deported? Should I just stop driving to be on the safe side?
Around half of all U.S. farm workers are undocumented immigrants, according to surveys conducted by the Department of Labor. And while mushroom farmers carefully maintain that, as far as they know, their employees are all work authorized, there's no evidence to suggest they buck that trend. Then, in late April, immigration officers arrested 12 workers at a mushroom house in the area, spiking community fears.
A lot of our employees are saying that they're just leaving to go back to Mexico. They just want to go home.
Megan Klotzbach handles human resources for Mother Earth Organic Mushrooms in West Grove, Pennsylvania. In the last couple of months, she says some employees have left and fewer people are knocking at their door looking for work. Politicians and farmers agree deporting workers is bad for business. But how to fix it splits along partisan lines. Steve Paul is a spokesman for Pennsylvania's conservative Republican Senator Pat Toomey.
Senator Toomey believes that we should raise the cap on low-skilled worker visas.
That's something mushroom growers like, as long as they'd be included, but that unions traditionally don't favor. Some growers also want amnesty for workers who've been here paying taxes. According to the USDA, productivity at Chester County's mushroom farms dipped by 2% last year. And while it's not clear why, it's enough to make farmers worried about a crucial resource, their workers. In Philadelphia, I'm Laura Benchoff for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we felt like it was sort of an unsung icon of the city.
Chocolate old-fashioned is my particular weakness. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 92 points on this Tuesday, 0.4%, 21,328. NASDAQ up 44 points, about 0.7%, 62 and 20. S&P 500 up 10, 0.4%, 24.40. Banks got a boost after the Treasury Department announced it's going to ease some regulations on them. Citigroup up about 0.5%. J.P. Morgan Chase ran up 0.3%. Tech stocks turned upward after a two-day slump. Microsoft firmed up 1.25% today. Intel buzzed up about 0.4%. Health insurer Centene perked up 2% today. It plans to expand into more affordable care insurance exchanges as many other providers pull out. Humana and Aetna, which have both withdrawn from the exchanges, also rallied. Humana up about 1.75% today. Troubled department store Sears discounted 2.5%. The company said it's cutting 400 jobs as part of yet another turnaround plan. You're listening to Marketplace. Hi, everybody. It's Kai Ryssdal. Marketplace is here because these days it's essential to have an independent source explaining how the economy really works, not just for CEOs, but for everybody. Your support keeps this kind of reporting coming, and it's especially vital now at the end of our fiscal year. So please visit marketplace.org/donate to contribute and to keep us in your world every day. And thanks.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. The New York Yankees are having a pretty good year. Four games ahead of Boston in the American League East. Rookie outfielder Aaron Judge is the hottest thing in baseball. And yet there are still empty seats in the stands. A lot of them, too, and not just this season either. An analysis by the New York Times shows ticket revenue for the Yanks has been falling since 2009. Marketplace's Ryan Kailath takes a look at why that might be.
It's generally a truism in baseball, or any sport, that if a team is up, attendance and ticket sales are too. That's why what's happening with the Yankees is especially confusing.
The Yankees are having an outstanding season. A lot of people are shocked by their performance.
Wayne McDonald chairs NYU's School of Sports Management, Media, and Business. The last time the team was doing this well, like when it won the title in 09, he says the Yankees were almost selling out their brand new stadium, 98% of seats or more. Now they're selling around 75%. Ticket revenue has dropped.
This is 161st Street, Yankee Stadium.
On a gray spring day outside Yankee Stadium, the Bronx Bombers are facing their rival Boston Red Sox for the first time this season. It's about an hour before first pitch, and crowds are streaming in off the subway.
Ice cold water, guys. Ice cold water. Ice cold. Ice cold.
In a truly New York sort of hustle, Clive Francis is selling dollar bottles of cold water on a cold day. Francis says he's noticed the crowds getting smaller.
Yeah, it's been going down a little bit over the years.
How long have you been selling water? How
I've been many? Selling water for like 7 years here.
The problems began the year after the Yankees opened their vast new stadium in 2009. NYU's Wayne McDonald.
Clearly the fans aren't coming now. Price is a big thing.
In the final few years of the old stadium, the average ticket price was about $33, according to website Statista.com. Now it's over 50. McDonald says
they were overpricing the average fan, the working class families who were the bedrock of the franchise. And that rubbed a lot of people the wrong way because they felt as if the new Yankee Stadium wasn't for them.
The Yankees don't share revenue numbers, but a team spokesman doesn't dispute that ticket sales are down. He says despite the decline, net revenue has been up year over year. The team gets money elsewhere. 130-plus corporate sponsorships, a cable network, renting out the stadium. Sean Decker is a born-and-bred third-generation Yankee fan from upstate New York.
The whole setup of the stadium is just off. I mean, you're so far removed from the action.
Decker says he's turned off by the price, and also because the new stadium feels like a shopping mall or a 3D commercial. What with the Toyota Terrace, Budweiser Party Deck, and the AT&T Sports Lounge.
this idea that you kind of have created a retail mall inside a stadium is almost something we're aspiring to.
Clive Lewis Skyped me from London. He's an architect at Hassel, and he's spent the last 20 years building sports arenas around the world. He says the mall experience is a trend in stadium design that's catching on worldwide. Teams want to give fans a reason to come to the ballpark, rather than just watching highlights at home or on Twitter. NYU's Wayne McDonald says the Yankees are experimenting with new ideas to improve the experience at the new stadium. Things from communal areas to a kids' playground in right field and more. What the Yankees didn't do is lower ticket prices. McDonald says doing that can box a team in.
If you start to lower your ticket prices, you're going to devalue the overall quality of the product. You're telling the fans that the Yankees aren't worth what they once were.
Longtime fan Sean Decker says he's glad the team's making money, but he doesn't need or want all the bells and whistles of a fancy retail stadium. His advice?
Don't forget about the day-to-day Yankee fans, the blue-collar fans. I mean, I don't think it has to be such a corporate thing. It's baseball.
The only other thing he'd want to say if he talked to management is go Yankees. In New York, I'm Ryan Kailoff for Marketplace.
Of all the things you've heard said about Los Angeles, I'm going to go out on a limb here and guess you've never really heard this. Los Angeles is kind of a donut place. There are more donut shops in LA County, if you count them up on Yelp, than there are in New York City or in Chicago and Cook County, Illinois. But it's not just the numbers that make the LA donut scene special. David Pearson is a staff writer at the Los Angeles Times. David, thanks for coming in.
Hey, thank you for having me.
There is nothing I like better than an interview in studio with a show and tell. And we have here... you tell us.
What we have here is the classic 994, which is the pink donut box that all of us in LA are very familiar with.
Okay, so first of all, does it have donuts in it?
It has a dozen donuts
in it. All right, good. We'll get to that in a minute. Why you're here, though, is because of this box, and it's truly iconic nature here, certainly in Southern California, and it's spreading.
We felt like it was sort of an unsung icon of the city, this thing that's sort of just in the background of our daily lives that we never really appreciated. And actually, my editor, who spent some time in New York, pointed out, what's the deal with these pink boxes?
Right.
Because he wasn't as familiar with them as we are.
You compared in your article to those coffee cups in New York with the Greek restaurant
That's
logo
right.
on them. Yeah.
The blue Anthora cups.
Right.
And I believe a lot of ink has been spilled, waxing poetic about this cup, but no love has ever been given to the pink box before.
And now it's time, by
now
God.
Now it's time.
Where did they come from? How did L.A. wind up as the pink donut box place?
So the pink boxes have existed for decades, but really they didn't reach this sort of... let's say unsung icon status until the 1970s. And that's when there was this demographic change in our local donut industry. Cambodian refugees started coming into the country after the Vietnam War, and they were drawn to the donut business, and they're the ones who made these pink boxes with donuts sort of synonymous.
And the difference between the donut industry here, you write, and elsewhere, for example, East Coast, Dunkin' Donuts, all that jazz, is that here it's mostly mom and pop, small shops.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's really sort of the special thing about LA's food scene is there's so many independent businesses, not just for donuts, but also hot dogs and hamburgers. You just don't see as much in other parts of the country. But because these refugees did such a good job building and sustaining this donut industry, it's been very difficult for these national chains to come and use their branded boxes.
Yeah. The pink ones are a hair cheaper than regular white boxes?
So the box became attractive to these refugees because they were just a few pennies less, and every penny counted when they were trying to sort of build a foothold in this country.
And if you're going through, 3,000 boxes a day or whatever, it makes a difference.
Exactly.
It seems, though, that as this economy changes, the donut box is changing as well.
So, second generation, the children of these refugees are starting to take over the business now. And they're sort of in a world now where there's, such thing as the artisan donut. And they're looking towards rebranding and taking their mom and pop shop to sort of the next level. And one of the things you can do is, order one of these glossy, customized boxes as well. It's branding, right?
What's funny is how disdainfully you say, "Oh, these glossy, customized boxes."
Well, I think it's a piece of nostalgia that I think that would be missed. And some donut shops have seized on that. Ironically, not one here. One in Portland called Voodoo Donuts, which is sort of a pioneer in the gourmet donut scene.
About as hipster as you can get, right?
Exactly. And they completely embrace the pink box. And I think, you know, their motto is good things come in pink boxes.
Let's cut to the chase. What kind of donuts do you bring?
Oh, just your classic glazed and sprinkle. Nothing fancy.
David Pearson from the Los Angeles Times. David, thanks a lot.
Hey, thank you so much.
This final note on the way out today, getting back to healthcare, where we started, actual healthcare this time, not tax policy, noting that the Congressional Budget Office's estimate for the House bill that passed last month would result in 23 million fewer people having health insurance than under current law. This item from Bloomberg today. In the past year, almost half of the $2 billion raised on the crowdsourcing site GoFundMe has been to pay for people's healthcare expenses. 4th of July is the deadline for the Senate vote. President Trump today, by the way, in a meeting with senators, called the House health care bill mean. That's a quote. And it is, in fact, the same bill that he celebrated in a Rose Garden ceremony after it passed. And we are out of here. The Dow up 92 points today, about 0.4%. NASDAQ up 44.7%. S&P 500 rose 10 points, 0.4%. Fed meeting wraps up tomorrow. Interest rates, all that jazz, we'll tell you about it. Tommy Andres is the producer on our special projects desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Ben Hethcote, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APN.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.